Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Seth Jones. He is a political scientist with RAND Corporation. He is an adjunct professor at Georgetown University and the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. And we will be talking about some of what you will find in his recently published book, In the Graveyard of Empires, America's War in Afghanistan. It's published by W.W. Norton. It takes a look at some recent history of Afghanistan, the involvement of the United States, particularly after 9/11, where we stand now and where things are likely going. He has visited Afghanistan over a dozen times since September 11th, 2001. He contributes regularly to many publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Newsweek. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are welcome. We ask only that people are brief in their comments and questions and that you stay focused on the topic. But otherwise, input from listeners is welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Also, we also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Again, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And toll-free 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions, comments are certainly welcome. Dr. Jones, hello.
Hello, it's good to be on. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. You know, I'm sure people will reflect on the title of your book and will point out that imperial powers as far back as Alexander the Great and as recently as the Soviet Union have stumbled in Afghanistan. And they would say, given that, why should we expect that the experience of the United States will be any different?
Well, this is an interesting question because people, probably outside of anthropologists, have tended to look, when they look for lessons historically, the lessons of the Soviet period or the three main British wars or Alexander the Great. And where there hasn't been a lot of serious looking is what caused stability during Afghanistan's most stable period. So between 1929 and 1978, what's generally called the Mujahideen dynasty, from Nadir Shah through Zahir Shah, Daoud Khan, and others, there was generally a 50-year period of stability, of relative stability in Afghanistan. So I think part of the issue is understanding that Afghanistan has become stable and understanding what factors have contributed to that. And I think what that means as we look historically at Afghanistan and at Afghanistan today is that when Afghanistan has been stable, it has been done primarily by Afghans. And I think that means, among other things, that expecting that the U.S. is going to win this with U.S. forces or British forces or Canadian forces, I think is barking up the wrong tree. Rather, finding a way to empower Afghans at the national and the local level to do this, it has been a recipe for success, as we've seen even in the 20th century.
Well, I think this is an important point that you make, that the United States, when it comes to a place like Afghanistan, it is our tendency to look at the central government to want to do a kind of top-down approach, to do what we can to support the central government, and that in a place like Afghanistan, that just doesn't really work, or at least you'd say that can't be the only approach.
Right, and where I would say central governments have strongly tried to establish order, it has not worked well. In between 1919 and 1929, the government of Aminullah Khan, the king, tried to create a strong central state along the lines of Ataturk's Turkey and Reza Shah's Iran, and it proved to be disastrous in rural areas. The same thing during the Soviet-backed regimes. They tried to establish central government reforms in rural areas of the country, and it proved disastrous. There were local revolts because most Afghans in rural areas did not want the central government playing that kind of role. So this is where the Mujahideens, for a 50-year period, strongly backed off on pushing the central government's law and order, taxation into rural areas. So I think that is a useful, very useful lesson in thinking about the role of the central government and how it will be viewed much of rural Afghanistan, including, frankly, in Pashtun areas where we've seen the groups like the Taliban have been able to establish their biggest support bases.
I think you've really pointed out that what people at the individual level identify very strongly with their neighborhood, and that there is not such strong identification, certainly with the civil, with the central government, and maybe not with the idea of being an Afghan. So having said that, what do people say at the village level? What do they want from the central government?
Well, I think they want, and frankly, this goes back to the former U.S. Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, when he made his sort of famous comment that all politics is local. So this fact I think has been true in other areas outside of Afghanistan, particularly true in tribal areas. I mean, I think what local Afghans, at least that I have talked to in a range of rural Afghanistan, have asked for the central government is an ability to, well, first of all, legitimacy. They would generally look for a central government that is at least viewed as legitimate. That is, corruption at a macro level is minimized, and that they can at least generally support. Other things that they generally look for is a security apparatus that, while it doesn't necessarily try and establish order in rural areas, can get involved occasionally if there are rebellions or major intertribal disputes, and that can, at the very least, provide some occasional services to locals. But for the most part, I think, to stay out of their lives on a regular basis. Because when you go to rural Afghanistan today, now, I've been in areas where they don't know who Hamid Karzai, the current president, is. In fact, I've been in areas where they thought U.S. military forces were Soviet forces. I mean, that gives you a general sense of the degree of isolation in some parts of Afghanistan.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Seth Jones. He's a RAND political scientist, adjunct professor at the Georgetown University and the U.S. Naval Postgrad School. He is the author of a newly published book, In the Graveyard of Empires. The subtitle is America's War in Afghanistan. It's published by W.W. Norton. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I think there are a number of very basic things that you say people have to understand as we think about the involvement of the United States in Afghanistan. And the first perhaps has to do with the broad sort of question of who it is we're fighting. So much of the coverage of the insurgency, you'd say, really is focused on the Taliban, as if that's all it is. And you say that really you have to understand that it's not just a Taliban, that what we're looking at here is a range of different networks, different organizations, some that have actually fought with each other in the past, and that really the insurgency is much more diffuse and it's much more decentralized than we think.
Well, a lot of the media reporting tends to overgeneralize the insurgency, tends to call it a Taliban insurgency, and the Taliban is certainly the largest group. I would say there are a range of different categories. One is insurgent groups that are trying to overthrow the government. And there are a range of them. The Taliban happens to be the largest. There are others. The Haqqani Network, which is led by former Mujahideen leader Jalaluddin Haqqani. There's the Hezb Islami, led by former Mujahideen leader Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. And there are a range of other groups, including Al-Qaeda, Uzbek militant groups, and frankly, a range of other mostly Sunni insurgent groups. There are also criminal organizations, drug trafficking organizations in the south, timber and illicit gem trading organizations in parts of the east. There are also a range of pro-insurgent tribes, sub-tribes, clans, and other local entities in a range of areas. And then you have states, state supporters. You have elements of Pakistan's Inter-Service Intelligence Directorate, elements of Pakistan's Frontier Corps, elements of the Iranian government, including the Revolutionary Guard Quds Force, that do provide some support to insurgent groups. And we've even seen in some cases elements of the Afghan government, including police forces, that have provided support to insurgents operating in rural areas. So it's a very complex network of groups. how these categories come together varies a lot by villages and districts. But we see, you know, various types of networks and insurgent groups and tribes coming together in different areas.
Yeah. What caused this insurgency to come to be after the Taliban was overthrown?
Well, I think there are at least three major factors. One is there clearly was a very weak central government in Afghanistan that had difficulty providing order and services. And the strategy in Afghanistan adopted by the international community was largely one of a top-down strategy. So the real strategy for success was built on this central government moving into rural areas, and it was not capable of doing this. And in addition to that, there became, as the drug trade proliferated, there became growing concerns that senior officials, mid-level officials and lower-level officials in the Afghan government were involved in narcotics trade, especially poppy. Second, there was really too little support from the U.S. and other international community actors towards that central government, among the lowest levels of any state or nation-building operation since World War II in terms of military forces and per capita assistance. And then third, really too much assistance that went from outside actors to insurgents, including the use of sanctuary in Pakistan in particular.
Hmm. I think you point here at something that, and I think others have made the same criticism, that it was not very long after the overthrow of the Taliban that the U.S. government, the Bush administration, started thinking about Iraq and taking away resources that might have been, were in Afghanistan, getting them positioned, getting ready to go into Iraq. How important was that, do you think, to the perhaps their lack of success to date in Afghanistan?
Well, I don't think it was the fundamental cause. I think most insurgencies really begin by government collapse in a given country. But I do think what's ironic, and as I began to talk to, for example, members of General Tommy Frank's targeting staff in November of 2001, while the war in Afghanistan was raging, before the famous efforts to target and kill Osama bin Laden in December of 2001 in Tora Bora, that elements of key elements of Tommy Frank's targeting staff were pulled off the Afghanistan-Pakistan front and pushed over to war planning for Iraq. And over then the course of 2002 and then 2003, what we saw is increasing elements of the U.S. military, the Central Intelligence Agency, State Department were shifted towards the planning and then execution of the war in Iraq. So when the insurgency began to get more serious by 2005, there just weren't elements. You couldn't pull large numbers of military forces to Afghanistan because they weren't there. They were being used, and that went for equipment. Predators and predators coming off the line and other unmanned aerial vehicles were primarily going to the Iraqi front. So it certainly was a major hindrance.
Yeah. How much, or maybe a better way to ask the question is, what is it that we have been doing in terms of nation building, trying to stabilize Afghanistan, that is not security related, that's not about, for example, trying to build up the Afghan army or the Afghan police?
Well, there have been a range of efforts involving government organizations like U.S., Afghan and international government organizations like the U.S. Agency for International Development, which have tried to build both macro and micro level development projects. So, for example, the Kajaki or Kajaki Dam, large hydroelectric dam initially built by the Americans several decades ago, there's a major effort to get all the turbines working in northern Helmand province, which will get electricity to a range of Afghans in areas that either don't have it at all or have very spotty access to it. In addition to that, there are a range of provincial reconstruction teams in provinces that are trying to improve and build development and infrastructure projects, wells, schools, roads, to improve the livelihood of Afghans.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that in Champaign County, our line number 4. Hello.
Hi, Mr. Jones. You were on after the RAND report that you released, which apparently didn't have much effect at the White House and Foggy Bottom, because you were, I think, recommending that military solution is no solution, that it's a dead end. It seems to me that this has been suggested widely. Two scholars who were consonant, and I don't know exactly what the timing was vis-a-vis that report, and correct me if I'm wrong about that. Barnett Rubin and Ahmed Rashid released or published on the Council of Foreign Relations journal, and the summary of their article is that a crisis in Afghanistan and Pakistan is beyond the point where more troops will help. U.S. strategy would be to seek compromises with insurgents while addressing regional rivalries and insecurities. It's notably called from great game to grand bargain, and it seems to me that pointing at women's rights issues and terrorism is just doesn't justify this intervention. And we have from Hans von Schäfer, who just stepped down from NATO Secretary Generalship. He frankly admitted at the Council of Foreign Relations at the Brookings Institute that there was something else at stake, and that's the idea of the great game. Basically, it borders Muslim republics of the former Soviet Union, Iran, Pakistan, and China. And it seems to me that unless we get to admitting that there's something else at stake here that Europe also has an interest in and is this great game that is a dead end, it seems to me, and that we do need to seek the council people who talk about a grand bargain between the rivalries in the area. Just calling it AFPAC seems to me, and I'll let you answer. I'll ask you to respond after this. Is just calling it AFPAC sort of reduces it to an idea that it's the problem of two nation states. And what you pointed out earlier about the complexity of the players in the situation, and the fact that the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan isn't even accepted by both parties, and that there really probably ought to be a Pashtunistan, and that because of the concentration of that group in the region, not that I'm suggesting a single monolithic separation of states by ethnicities, but it seems that what we're doing is almost designed to make a fundamentalist Pashtunistan come into being. It's very frustrating, and it must be for you too, because if I'm right, you had this RAND report some time ago that suggested that escalating and putting in a guy like McChrystal in is really the wrong way to go. Kilcullen has even abandoned him. I'm too much full of this, and I'd like for you to unpack some of that and respond to this.
Sure. Well, I certainly never argued that the General McChrystal, putting him in place was a bad idea. But what I did say, and what I have said, and what I will say is that the solution to Afghanistan is not only or even predominantly a military one. While I do think security is important, and Afghans in a range of areas do want security at the village level and as they travel from area to area, that is certainly important. But part of this does get into a much broader almost great game level, and that is, I think, what a lot of people don't understand is that there are other factors that are motivating a range of different actors in the region. So if we take, for example, one of the more significant ones, the continuing friction between Pakistan and India. They've come to war several times. There have been cases recently after the Mumbai attacks where war was viewed as strongly possible, because there were links back to militant groups, not just operating in Pakistan, but that had links with Pakistan's intelligence service. By 2001, or before 2001, we had a situation in Afghanistan where Pakistan had very strong links to the Taliban regime that was governing Afghanistan. After the U.S. overthrow of the Taliban regime in 2001, what we saw over the course of the next several years is India, Pakistan's arch rival,
begin to make inroads, not just in development and reconstruction, but with the Afghan government. It put up a range of consulates, provided a lot of money to Afghan members of parliament and other government officials, and it became really a strategic ally of the Afghan government. Well, this is unacceptable for much of Pakistan's national security establishment. And so we're at a situation now where Pakistan, I think, has felt strategically surrounded. On one border, it's got India itself, and another border, it's got what key members of its national security establishment view as an Indian-Afghan axis against it. So I think that has contributed to what we've seen. Some elements of the Pakistan government have indeed provided some support to Afghan insurgent groups. And so we get this soft power strategy that the Indians have adopted in Afghanistan and a hard power strategy that the Pakistanis have adopted, but it does certainly impact what goes on in Afghanistan, and I haven't even talked about the Iranian role. So I think this some of these broader regional factors are extraordinarily important.
If I might have a response.
Yes, quickly, please.
The unexamined motives of the out-of-the-area groups is what I was also wondering about, and I'm preoccupied with it, and that's the NATO role, as I outlined it. It has to do with the great game, and if you're really serious about your idea that this is has something to do with an imperial and geopolitical role from the U.S. and from the councils of Europe, that I think that really needs to be examined and criticized, because it is... You know, we aren't in there as neutral players who just want women to be able to go to schools, and there's much, much more at stake, and it's generally unexamined. One of the few people that's taking it is Tariq Ali, and I commend people's attention to his Myth of the Good War and New Left Review and other things that he's written on it, and I don't know whether you'll... I don't suppose that you'll go that far, but I think that it really needs to be examined and criticized, and I'll make you listen.
All right.
Yeah, well, I mean, in my view, most of the NATO countries operating in Afghanistan, in my view, have tended to be motivated for basic reasons of supporting the NATO alliance. I mean, I don't think there are major imperialist tendencies of the Germans, the Swedes, the Norwegians, the Italians, the Spanish, the Canadians who are operating in southern Afghanistan, and a range of NATO countries. And in fact, quite the opposite, because the general views among a range of NATO countries and conversations with their population is to pull forces out. We've seen it actually now with the British. The Canadians look like they'll be leaving, at least from Kandahar in 2011. There are strong moves from the Dutch to move out of Oruzgan province as well. So, I mean, there are major discussions within NATO countries about how important this region is. And even in places like southern Afghanistan, we've seen, we're moving in a direction where a lot of the NATO countries, including the Canadians and the Dutch, are getting out. So I think there are huge debates within these countries about the strategic importance of Afghanistan, and my general hunch is that we'll see a lessening, if anything, of their force and civilian presences in Afghanistan over the next few years, because they just don't view it as strategically important.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Seth Jones. He is a RAND political scientist, also adjunct professor at Georgetown University and the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. He's visited Afghanistan over a dozen times since the September 11th attacks, contributes regularly to many publications, including The New York Times, Washington Post, Newsweek. His new book, just recently out, is In the Graveyard of Empires. The subtitle is America's War in Afghanistan, and it's published by W.W. Norton. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, you've made the point here that one of the things that you really have to consider and keep in mind is that all of Afghanistan's neighbors have, for a long time, been involved in the country, sometimes helpful, sometimes not. And we talked about Pakistan, India. You mentioned Iran. There was also Russia. I think, though, people will say, yes, I can see that, but they'll want to keep coming back to Pakistan and talk about past support, for the Taliban and about the presence of Al-Qaeda and Taliban in Pakistan just over the Afghan border and people very easily going back and forth. And I think that there are a lot of people would say, we still have to do something about that. And they will say, well, why is it that the government of Pakistan hasn't been more helpful?
Well, it's a very, very good question and an important subject. And I would say that the situation is complicated in Pakistan. The Pakistan government has clearly gone after a range of militant groups in Pakistan. They've been helpful in capturing a range of Al-Qaeda and foreign fighters from the beginning, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Abu Faraj al-Libi, Ramzi bin al-Shib, and a range of others. They've also, as we've seen recently, gone in and conducted operations in Bajur, in the northern part of the federally administered tribal area, and in more recently in Swat. So the Army, the Frontier Corps, and other elements of Pakistan's national security establishment they've lost a large number of forces to conducting operations against militant groups. At the same time, there are elements of the government that continue to believe that it is important to provide assistance to proxy organizations operating both in the Indian front, that is especially Kashmir, as well as in Afghanistan. So what we've seen is in parts of North Waziristan, for example, in Pakistan, in the federally administered tribal areas, we've got support for a group called the Haqqani Network, which has been involved in a range of the more sophisticated and high-profile suicide attacks in Afghanistan, including in Kabul, the Serena Hotel, some of the Mumbai attacks we saw a couple of months ago in Kabul, as well as Mullah Muhammad Omar's Afghan Taliban. So this is a huge problem. I mean, the fact that every major insurgent group operating in Afghanistan has a sanctuary on Pakistani soil is a very serious problem. That doesn't mean the cause of the insurgency is necessarily in Pakistan, because there's a huge cause in Afghanistan. But it does mean that the ability of these groups to operate from Pakistani soil, especially senior members of the group, the Taliban operates primarily from Balochistan province, is a huge hindrance, because marine forces can clear areas in southern Helmand or try in the south of Afghanistan. But the command node lies just across the border in Balochistan province of Pakistan. So it does make counterinsurgency operations excruciatingly difficult if part of the command element lies across a border that nobody but the U.S. seems to abide by.
Well, then, taking a step back, though, you say that, yes, Pakistan is very important, but what you have to do is try to see the entire context of the involvement of a number of countries and how those things are connected. I mean, how does one develop a sort of a comprehensive plan that takes into account the interests, the domestic political interests of all of the neighbors and how that influences their involvement in Afghanistan?
Well, on the Pakistani-Indian front, I think a very important beginning point for dialogue is to understand what is driving elements of the Pakistani government to provide some support to Afghan militant groups. And that inevitably leads to a discussion about the Indian presence in Afghanistan. So the question is, are there steps that can be taken to relieve some of those security concerns from Pakistan, whether it's reducing the number of Indian consulates, terminating some of the development projects being built in or near the Afghan-Pakistan border, or a range of other steps? Are there steps that can be taken to reduce Pakistan's security concerns? On the Iranian front, that's probably a separate issue, because the key question then is, what is motivating Iran to provide some usually small arms support to the Taliban and a few other insurgent groups? And that, I think, has more to do with the U.S.-Iranian relationship, and that is that I think the better U.S.-Iranian relation, the U.S.-Iranian relationship becomes, the less incentive Iran is going to have to provide support to Sunni groups that it historically has tried to fight. So I think in that sense, part of this is finding ways that the U.S. can cooperate with Iran on areas of mutual interest like counter-narcotics or energy in the area that that might reduce some of Iran's security concerns. So I think these are at least two examples on the dialogue front that would that could potentially reduce some of the recent states in the region are backing militant groups.
We have a couple of callers here to get in, and we'll go next to someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. What right, what moral right, primarily, does the U.S. have to invade and kill people in Afghanistan that the Russians didn't have? Or would you agree that the Russian invasion was equally justified with that of the United States?
Well, I think the issue becomes, you know, what is the general view of Afghans? I mean, what we saw in 2001 was a horrific a Taliban regime that was one of the most significant human rights abusers in modern history. In the soccer stadium that I've been to several times in Kabul, it executed women in some cases for not wearing the burqa and being properly dressed. So in that sense, when the U.S. got involved with the support of the United Nations and a range of other communities for getting rid of the Taliban regime, it had UN Security Council approval. So from a legal perspective, I think there was a strong argument that there was international support, including from several Security Council resolutions and in that sense international legal legitimacy. And for that matter, the public opinion polls in 2001 and 2 and 3 were strongly supportive of the international presence in Afghanistan, because people generally reviled the Taliban regime. So in 2002 and 3, for example, Asia Foundation polls showed as many as 70% of Afghans strongly supported a UN and a U.S. presence in Afghanistan as a source of stability. Now, those levels have gone down because the war has increasingly raged. But I think from both from a Security Council resolution and from an Afghan sentiment, there was strong support for getting rid of the Taliban regime. The support levels were significantly different in the 1978-1979 periods, when the Soviet invasion was immediately triggered a massive revolt in Pashtun areas. It actually took about 4 or 5 years in this particular case.
I think it'd be hard to contend that there is more support for an American invasion than there was for a Russian invasion. And that, I mean, as you mentioned earlier, you know, there are many people in Afghanistan who consider the Americans foreign invaders and confuse them with the Russians, and not unreasonably so, because in each case you have troops from abroad who are the primary cause of the difficulty. The unpopularity of the Taliban government, is hardly a justification for a U.S. invasion. Surely the U.S. invasion is much more predicated on what the Pentagon calls the long war and the need to control the Mideast energy resources. I mean, Afghanistan is Pipelinistan, and that's why the U.S. is there with no more legal right than the Russians had. The U.N. resolutions you refer to simply recognize the fact that the U.S. had invaded Afghanistan and was there. They didn't justify it. No more than they justify the invasion of Iraq.
Well, I think there are problems with that on two fronts. I mean, there are some valid points, but I think one is the opinion data is pretty clear along these lines. Large numbers of Afghans strongly supported, up to 70-80% strongly supported the UN and the U.S. role in Afghanistan beginning in 2001 and then moving through 2002. The other thing is, we may use words like U.S. occupation, but in 2001, in the early years of this, we're talking about 100 U.S. special operations and CIA forces, and by far the vast bulk of the effort was done in the north by Afghan Tajiks and Uzbeks, and in the south by Pashtuns, by Popalzai, Barakzai, Nurzai, and other Pashtun tribes that revolted against the Taliban. So In the early years, 2001 and 2 and 3, cities were conquered by Afghans. Kandahar was liberated by Afghans. Mazar-e-Sharif was liberated largely by Afghans. So, you know, the Soviets had well over 100,000 forces in Afghanistan. In the early years, especially at the beginning, the U.S. had barely 100. So it was a completely different type of effort. And I would argue in the early stages anyway, this was largely just American forces enabling Afghan tribes, sub-tribes, clans, and in some cases other entities to push the Taliban out. So it was hard to call that a massive invasion along the lines of the Soviet 1979 especially December 1979 invasion.
We just have about 10 minutes. I have another caller I want to get. Just to expand on this point, though, I think one of the points that you make is that the people of Afghanistan have seen outside powers come and go, and they've seen the United States come and go as well. What they want to know is, what kind of commitment is the United States making here? And then I suppose then the additional question would be, well, what really would they be looking for from the United States?
The commitment question is a very, very important one. The U.S. reputation in this region is mixed at best. People do remember that after the Soviets left, that the U.S. left as well, and that U.S. support dwindled to minuscule levels. And so in that sense, there is concern today that, you know, the U.S. staying power will be short-lived, and there is some historical precedent for being concerned about this. As to what they want from the U.S., I think, you know, most Afghans, again, going back to that Tip O'Neill phrase, that all politics in Afghanistan, in my view, tends to be local, and that is they want both Afghan government and international forces to support legitimate local institutions, tribal institutions in places like the South, and other legitimate local actors. So I think they would generally like to see leveraging and support to local communities so that they can establish order and deliver services at a local level, and at the very least that the U.S. can help improve the legitimacy of the Afghan government. Because, look, the corruption has become a very serious concern, and there's been very little progress on dealing with it. So I think those are at least some of the things, as I've talked to some Afghans, about what they're looking for.
All right. Let's talk with someone next in Fisher, line two. Hello.
Yes. I have 2 points. First, you know, I'm really surprised, and it's probably genetic, caused through thousands of years of heritage, you know, why those people are so violent. Second, the U.S. strategy caused, and they know what the roadside bombings that have killed so many U.S. soldiers just recently, you know, I fail to understand why the U.S. does that, and if they're going to be there, why they're putting so many of our soldiers at jeopardy and they're getting killed. So I'll just give you that, and I'll listen.
Okay.
Very good questions. On the first one, I mean, I would say in general that I don't think that Afghans are any more or less prone to violence than other countries. What you do have, though, is because of the sort of decentralized nature of politics, foreigners tend to be viewed with some suspicion. So Afghanistan has historically played a very, very important geostrategic role. It sat for a while between the British and the Russian empires, and it was a major source of influence and conflict between Russia and the British, and then during the Cold War between the Americans and the Soviets. So it's played a role, and if you could go back even further between some of the Mughal empires, the role of Alexander the Great, it's played an important role strategically between empires or along key economic trade routes. So when foreigners have come into Afghanistan, especially foreign armies, I think it has led to a backlash. And I would argue that's the source of some of this, a significant part of this violence. On the second issue, on the strategy and the roadside bombs and the violence, and how does the U.S. allow this? Well, I actually think, I mean, in general, when you're operating in an environment that you do not control, that is at least influenced by insurgent groups that use improvised explosive devices, this is the danger that you face. I mean, what's interesting, though, is if you compare Soviet deaths, which are about 15,000, to U.S. deaths, which are in the neighborhood of 1,000 now, I mean, there's a huge order of magnitude difference. U.S. has lost a lot less than the Soviets did during their time in Afghanistan. So, but I think to some degree, some of these improvised explosive devices, roadside bombs, suicide attacks are going to be inevitable when U.S. or other Afghan or NATO forces push into areas that are controlled or influenced by insurgent groups. There is really no way around running into these sorts of problems.
All right. Frankfurt next, I believe. Our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know why we're there in the first place. Because, I mean, I've heard stories, differing opinions, I should say. And my personal opinion is I have not been explained why we're there in the first place. They don't want to be civilized. I mean, they don't want to be changed, I should say. I mean, I look at people every day and I tell them, why would you want somebody to come into this country and tell you basically how to live your life? And we're getting to that point right now in this country, but it's getting kind of crazy. Like, I honestly don't understand why we went over there in the first place. It wasn't about terrorism, because if it was terrorism, I look at it this way. There's too many politicians out there, and there's too many chiefs and not enough doors.
Now let's get a comment here from the guest. I think that as we're getting short on time, I think that the caller raises a good point. He has this basic feeling that maybe the U.S. we've not had involvement of two administrations there, and from one moment to the next, often the justification for what it is we're doing seems to shift. The basic question is, okay, what are we doing there?
Well, this is a very good question. It's a very important one. It's very important that this question keeps coming up and that we actually debate this, because failing to answer this question and failing to answer it well is an extraordinarily serious problem. In my personal view, I see the biggest problem and the biggest threat to the U.S. coming from this area in terms of links between major terrorist groups operating, especially on the Pakistani side of the border. But, most of the areas that militant groups are operating, like al-Qaeda and some of the Uzbek militant groups, have been along the Afghan-Pakistani federally administered tribal areas region. But if you go back to 2005, London faced attacks on its underground, successful attacks on its underground or metro system by British individuals with direct links, and two of them, including Mohammad Siddiqui Khan, had gone back for training in Pakistan. In 2006, we saw a very serious transatlantic plot, an effort to take down airplanes going from the UK to the United States and Canada, which is why we can't bring liquids and gels onto planes today. 2007 and 8, we saw major plots foiled in France, Spain, Germany, and Denmark, all with links back to either al-Qaeda itself or linked militant groups operating in the Pakistan-Afghan border region. So I would say, what does this all mean? Well, I would say a range of intelligence assessments coming from the Americans, the British, the Canadians, the Dutch, the Germans strongly indicate that there is a major threat to a range of these countries, including the United States, from terrorist groups that have both the ability and the will to conduct large-scale attacks against civilians in these countries. And in my personal view, this is really the primary reason why these areas are of interest to and should be of interest to countries like the United States, because I do believe there is a serious threat from these areas.
About 3-4 minutes, we'll try to get one more caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Just a couple of points I'd like to speak to. One is the perception that these people have been there from the beginning of time, and that the people that Alexander fought were the people that are there today. And that's only partially true. It was largely inhabited by Iranian peoples of various sorts. Today there's a very large Turkic element and other elements that didn't come in until shortly before the Middle Ages. So trying to draw conclusions about modern Afghanistan from what happened in Alexander's day is probably dangerous. The second is that they're so terribly violent. Well, there's a great deal of violence now, but that tends in any war. And historically, the Mughals in particular were noted for their very controlled governance, that after the invasion of India, and even during the invasion of India, there was very little indiscriminate killing, although there were some very bloody battles. And that's all I'd like to say, but would appreciate your comment.
All right.
Well, I strongly agree that that especially the deeper one gets into history, the more careful one has to be about making any conclusions about the relevance of lessons from those time periods. I think there is no question about that. And we have seen, even among tribal dynamics in southern Afghanistan or eastern Afghanistan, even changes over the last 30 years of warfare and drought and forced migration. So there clearly are vast differences, and over time those differences become more acute. So one has to be extremely careful in drawing any sort of lesson. So I think on that point, I strongly agree with the caller's warning.
About 2 minutes, anything that you might want to say about the upcoming elections?
Well, what's interesting, actually, is how little they actually feel like elections. I mean, there's been one debate, and President Karzai didn't participate in it. We have no polling data on any reliable polling data on who's you know, what the support bases are. It appears that the two most significant candidates tend to be President Karzai and Abdullah, who's the former foreign minister, and actually the former foreign minister of the Northern Alliance. But we don't see a lot of campaigning across the country. I mean, it barely feels like an election period at all. We don't have political parties in Afghanistan. This is still a country that I still think fundamentally does not have a real serious political process yet. So it's still trying to find itself and understand what real elections actually are and should look like.
And earlier in the year, it seems that there was a lot of reporting about the fact that the Obama administration was really not very happy with President Karzai and perhaps might not be unhappy if he was not reelected.
Well, there were indications along these lines, and there apparently were some very strong contentious discussions between the Vice President of the United States and President Karzai. At the very least, though, the U.S. has backed off on Afghanistan in terms of its role in the elections, and certainly backed off on supporting any candidate, and primarily tried to focus on having at least legitimate and fair elections. And that's where we are today. And there are some clear concerns, though, about the ability to have elections in violent parts of the country, whether there's going to be voter fraud. And I think in this sense, this is what the U.S. has at least tried to focus on rather than backing someone.
So is there reason to be optimistic?
Well, I think there's reason to be optimistic if the U.S. and the international community begin to back off on trying to conceive of the solution in Afghanistan coming from Kabul and being entirely top-down. Mm-hmm. And I think if one learns lessons from the more stable periods of Afghanistan's history, including the Mujahideen dynasty from really 1929 to 1978.
Our guest, Seth Jones, is a political scientist at RAND, adjunct professor at Georgetown University. His new book is In the Graveyard of Empires, America's War in Afghanistan. It is published by W.W. Norton. Dr. Jones, thanks very much.
Thanks a lot for having me. It's been a pleasure.